Gas Committee meeting to order. It's now a beautiful, blustery day in Juneau on February 27th, 5 minutes after 10. We have a quorum. Donald Dyson, Vice Chairman Fate, and myself are here. And we'll get you on it. I want to thank our guests, Mr. Steve Allman and George Finley, for braving the Juneau weather coming to the airport last night. We were discussing pilot techniques of landing and wind shears, which apparently was the case last night in Juneau. And we're really glad you're here in light of the weather, especially. If the weather was any nicer in Juneau, there'd be millions of people living here.
So as soon as you get here.
With that, you gentlemen would like to give us your presentation and maybe give you an idea of how long it takes.
I'm guessing 30, 40 minutes.
Great.
Go through that and have time for questions after that.
That's good.
Great. That's a guess, yes. Mr. Chairman and the committee, I certainly appreciate this opportunity. For the record, my name is Steve Allman. I am an employee of Phillips Petroleum Company. I am part of the overall Phillips effort to commercialize gas, but I'm here today representing the Alaska North Slope LNG project. Would like to do a small presentation and then certainly answer any questions that you might have. I say small presentation. I plan to go into quite a bit of detail and try to clip on through it, try to give you as much information as we can, and then certainly we can circle back and take your questions. For those of you who may not know, the Alaska North Slope LNG project consists of Phillips Alaska BP Exploration, Foothills Pipelines Corporation, and Marubeni Corporation. My plan here this morning is just to give you a bit of an overview of the project, talk some about market essentials, and then focus on what we did in the stage one effort, what some of those results were, and then talk about where we're going now with our go-forward strategy for a stage two plan. Just a little bit of background. This project was initiated by the sponsors to attempt to develop an economic and commercially viable project. After the Stranded Gas Act was enacted, ARCO solicited interest beginning 1997-1998 to try to form a sponsor group. Our current sponsors in this group, as I just mentioned, are these companies with working interest of Phillips having about 30%, BP Exploration 26%, Foothills Pipeline 25%, and Marubeni Corporation around 19%. The sponsors completed an 18-month, $12 million engineering and design effort in August of 2000 as our stage one effort. We're now focused on the many commercial issues and aspects ongoing for stage two. And I'm here today to try to update you on our past ongoing efforts on this project. Just somewhat of a roadmap, if you will, of where we're trying to go with ANS LNG commercialization. For us, it's about defining an economically viable project. That means trying to find the right size for us to gain market entry, which is what we focused on in our stage one efforts. It's about innovative design and ways to minimize our capital cost. Again, a focus of stage one and a continuing focus in stage two. Certainly to minimize our commercial constraints, and that will be a lot of the discussion I'll focus on in our stage two work. Test, rework the economic viability of the project. Try to find a project that is commercially viable at the end of the day. Then to develop through parallel activities, and by parallel activities I mean bringing the market efforts along at the same time with the design efforts, with the permitting efforts, and with the commercial and fiscal activities, to what we call our big closing, where we bring together the sales and purchase agreement efforts, where we bring together the final permitting efforts, so that we can then begin to construct the project and then ultimately operate the facility. Just a quick overview. I'm not going to go through all of these items on this page, but just to give you an overview of the project basics, we are suggesting that we would buy gas from the producers on the North Slope, build an 800-mile pipeline to either Valdez or Anderson Bay or to Nikiski and to Cook Inlet. At that point, we would manufacture LNG, ship it to the markets, with our target markets being Japan, Korea, Taiwan, and other markets, which I'll discuss in just a few more minutes. In fact, we're to that point. Let's talk just, if we can, a few minutes about market essentials.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. Do you want to ask questions on the fly, or do you want to wait till Alden?
We can ask on the fly. If we can keep it a minimum, that'd be fine. Representative Dyson, also Representative Corrine, and joined us some time ago, and Representative James has honored us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Steve, what does Marabini bring to the table in this consortium?
Good point. And we're, in fact, I'm just on this slide getting ready to get into part of what they bring to the table. They're a Japanese trading company. They're doing business throughout East Asia and throughout the world. We have a market liaison office established in their office to where all of the different markets can contact them, give us a source in Japan, specifically representing the Alaska North Slope LNG project. Certainly the rest of us with the Phillips and the BPs have our offices, have our marketing efforts ongoing within these same countries, but this is specifically focused on Alaska North Slope LNG project for them to ask questions and for them to respond.
They're kind of a wholesaler. Is that what they do? I mean, do they take commodities like gas and enter into the agreements with the customers?
Primarily, they are basically a trading company and haven't been that directly involved as far as a LNG seller. Is that where you're going with this?
Yeah.
Yeah, they are involved in other projects around the world with LNG. Do you recall it here?
I don't on the surface,
right.
But that's basically what they do.
As far as our marketing expertise, we do have good lead-in questions. Thank you very much. We do have Marubeni Corporation working for us in Tokyo. Our updates that we get are perpetual because we do have people on the ground. We do have the Phillips people that are working there. We do have two people within the Phillips offices that are there full-time. They can give us this feedback on what's going on in the market. And certainly BP brings their own staff working on Asian market trade. As far as the fundamentals that we see, there are two that jump out at us time and time again. It's about commercial viability, and it's about a market that's ready for gas from Alaska projects. The commercial viability is about having the right size project that can get a toehold into the marketplace and a significantly advanced project. It's about being competitive with other new projects that are trying to enter the marketplace. A market that's ready for gas from the Alaska project is going to require an initial new demand. We're going to talk about the demand issues here in just a minute. We see that as first being the incremental expansions from existing LNG projects, and then the most competitive new LNG projects entering the market at that time that can provide secure supply and that can deliver when the market is ready. Market analysis. We've done very in-depth market analysis. We did our first one in 1999 for the sponsor group. We revisited it completely again in spring of 2000. And by the end of stage two, we will have another market assessment, again, from this perpetual information that we're receiving feedback on. Our initial target markets, as I said, were Japan, Taiwan, and South Korea. We looked at the emerging markets of China and India, and in stage two, we are looking at the U.S. And Mexican West Coast markets as potential entries for LNG. The analysis that we've done, to try to encapsulate that just a little bit, it's around what are the nuclear power capacities, what about coal-fired versus LNG and gas, how do we deal with competing fuels, deregulation of electricity is an issue, et cetera, competition with other pipelines that could be in the area. All of those pieces for all of those countries going forward.
Yeah. Just quickly, if you could, thank you. What does deregulation of electricity do to sale of natural gas?
What does it do to
deregulation? Well, period. But deregulation of electricity, you mentioned here, is an issue. And just intuitively, I don't know what that does. Does that help us or hurt us in selling our gas?
Well, in different places, it can mean different things as far as what the deregulation picture means. Generally, you think of any type of deregulation activity allowing other market entrants into the marketplace. And that's the, we're trying to gauge the impact of that and the effects of that in each one of these marketplaces.
So you generally would think it would help us?
Generally, yes.
Thank you, sir.
Certainly. As far as where we are on our view of the marketplace, certainly we believe it's fiercely competitive. I have several slides here, a very busy slide, but wanted to give you a feel for what we think some of the competing projects around the world could be. Whether these all come to fruition is yet to be seen, certainly. As you see, I have two slides here that total up to 68 to 75 MTPA of LNG potential, including Alaska. Our outlook for demand, supply demand on this, is around 20 to 40 million tons of LNG by the year 2010. This is with 60 to 80 million tons of potential projects that would be chasing this. Again, fiercely competitive. The problematic trends that I think Mr. Meraki pointed out to you are certainly the downward price pressures that we see, the shorter contracts and spot deliveries that are out there. Certainly, we believe that the Asian marketplace will continue as a more of a long-term base supply, but that there will be pressure to see more spot sales develop over time. So from our perspective, the smaller market entry we can come up with reduces our market entry risk and gives us a better chance to get into the marketplace initially. The other competition we have to deal with is certainly as Alaska North Slope gas is U.S. gas demand. The U.S. gas demand, from our perspective, is going to be how do we compete with wellhead value on an LNG project with what may be able to happen with a lower 48 gas pipeline. And certainly we'll have to do that. Just for illustration, we have a graph here that shows you the new source needs expected in the year 2010. What I've taken is the Tokyo gas presentation high demand number of 135 million tons per annum, converted all this to BCF per day, by the way, subtracted off what they thought would already be available, would already be supplied, which was the 80 million tons. So this is the 55 million ton level that they were talking about. So there's about 8 BCF a day of new Asian demand expected, and there's about 52 billion cubic feet per day of U.S. demand. Obviously, each one of these will have other suppliers besides us pursuing them for this, and there will be other gas sources certainly within the U.S., but this gives you order of magnitude of the size of the different marketplaces that we're dealing with and that we have to keep in mind. That's it for market essentials. Now I'd like to talk a little bit about what we did in stage one, just to give you a flavor for what went on. Certainly our major advance, as we saw it, was development of our market entry project. We had been historically looking at 14, 15 million ton market entry projects costing in the $14, $15 billion range. We did develop a 7 to 8 million ton per year project at $6.8 billion. We didn't just cut that number in half. That project has been completely redesigned in a way to defer costs as we need to defer costs, to minimize any pre-investment that we have on those costs. We believe it significantly improves our market entry probability to have a smaller size. Certainly that's the feedback that we've received from the marketplace, that a smaller market entry would give us a better chance to compete. It significantly reduces the capital costs. Obviously, by cutting the cost in half, we've also limited the risk that we would have in that regard. But the beauty of it is that it is still expandable to a 14 million ton project if and as the markets develop. Our mandate internally was to come up with a project that could be economically standalone at a 7 to 8 million ton project, even if we weren't able over time to expand this project, as we hope to do. I call this my snake slide, for lack of a better term for this. This is an extremely busy slide. Gives you some feel for how the redesign and how things had changed. Yes, we did indeed cut the size of the project. We cut the volume of the project. We believe in year one that we can start with zero compression other than compression at the gas treatment facility and into the LNG facility. But as far as field compression, this is expense that we can defer further out into the project and, again, help us on an economic basis. You see the different pipe size changes. We're talking two LNG trains that start out at 3.6 million tons that with Alaska's ambient temperature and other innovations, we believe can each be expanded to 7 million tons each. You see the smaller tank sizes that we came up. And then the ramp up. Before, we were going to need a steady, ongoing ramp up of several years to make sure that we could gain market entry here. With this type of a ramp up, with a 3.5 the first year, 2, and then 1.5, again, we've eliminated that ongoing risk of getting into the marketplace. Again, it's a very busy slide. I understand that. The technical activity that happened in stage one, here are the headings of the different categories of system integration, pipe and route, marine terminal site design, pipeline design, et cetera. You can read down through those. The point I wanted to make here is there was a lot of work that was done, and there were three major themes out of this. One, we had significant external input into our process. I'll talk to you a little bit more about the number of contractors, et cetera, that were involved in this process. And when we had workshops and when we began to brainstorm the various issues and problems, we brought in the experts and we brought in from across our companies as well as the external players, set them down in the same room. While we have full-time equivalent staff of 14 people for this project in stage one, we had over 100 different people involved in the process from the different corporations. They'd come in for the week, the 2 weeks, bring their expertise, and then leave, and then we'd move on to the next step. There's been one paper already released on some of the work that was done here. One of our managers that led part of the engineering work will be making a presentation at LNG 13 in Seoul here in late May, I believe it is, again, talking about the innovation and the development that we were able to come up with on coming up with this market entry project. I'm often asked, why do you still carry two routes and sites? The point for us on route and site selection gets back to the pacing item being that we come up with a cost-competitive project, and we need to be able to do that at either location. The other way to put that in our mind is neither site works if the overall project isn't doable. And as we talked about a minute ago, or maybe I didn't talk about a minute ago, but I do need to mention that the stage one engineering and construction and design work was done for both projects. So as we developed all of that work you saw on the previous slide, we did it for both routes and sites. There are some reasons for keeping both of these routes and sites alive. It gives us flexibility. It gives us options. It's always good to have options as you're moving forward trying to make a project happen, particularly if the marketplace isn't quite ready for your project to go yet. From the Nikiskie standpoint, obviously there's the benefit of the in-state gas sales. You've heard the discussion of 70-75% of the people living along the pipeline corridor. There are existing markets there. There's the growth opportunities. There's the existing infrastructure. There's opportunities for us to include the Kenai LNG plant in this process. And there's a potential for a lower cost of in-state gas by not needing a long spur line for us if we did go down to Valdez Roof for somebody to build a spur line back over to the Anchorage Bowl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Steve, what are the advantages to the Valdez-only route?
The Valdez route has the existing TAPS pipeline corridor. That means you've already got an opportunity with possibly less resistance from environmental issues, possibly less landowner issues to deal with in that regard.
So on the next slide, I couldn't help but jump in, but say that A3 design difference is doable with the current market time. So I guess I'm having a hard time with that one. If you already have permits for a route and you have fewer environmental hurdles because of the permitting and the route's already been, right-of-way's already there, how can a western route, the Cook Inlet route, be permitted at the same time frame?
Okay, again, Just going back on that one, we're saying doable within the current market timing needs. That certainly by the end of the decade when, as Ms. Meraki was discussing, that there will be market opportunity that we can have permitting done to either location in our minds. Our base case talks about a 12 to 18 month difference. We actually believe in our low case that with government agency support, we can do it in less time. Obviously, in a high case, it may take more time than that. There's no exact science into the permitting world, but we brought in experts from Phillips and the other partners that have done permitting across Alaska, permitting across the United States and the world, who have a proven record in doing that. We brought in external permitting experts, had discussions with them. They did an extensive analysis for us to come up with this conclusion, as well as we sat down with the JPO, we sat down with RCA. I've been with the group to go to talk to them in Washington, D.C., Department of Energy, Department of Resources, and, of course, the Office of Fossil Fuels. And we've come up with it. That's our view of the world, that's how it can be done. And I would also like to make the note that the Nikiski route does not go through Denali Park. I get asked that question every once in a while. We do not plan to bring the Nikiski route to Denali National Park. Moving on through what went on in Stage 1 activities, once you've come up with your design, then you start talking about cost estimating. Both our design work and our cost estimating exceeded our expectations for what we intended to accomplish in Stage 1. Our target was to be somewhere in that area that you see there as far as the estimate accuracy. We actually got to a plus 40, minus 20 level of cost estimating, and in some of our areas took it even further than that and got to beyond the preliminary stage, as we say, which is just pre-construction type of engineering design. Just summarizing the Stage 1 work, here's a photograph of our Stage 1 library. Has all the documents. What you can't see is all the map drawers that are on the side, other side where we've gone and done the topographical maps on all the way along the pipeline routes, as well as the aerial photographs, as well as the video from the helicopter, which I wanted to participate in, but didn't get the opportunity to. Here's just a list of the different numbers of studies, just kind of for point of reference. We won't go down through those. We did have 26 outside contractors, all the way from engineering and design and cost consultants to state consultants to government entity consultants throughout that. The point being here that Stage 1 work was completed on time. It was done within our budget, which was done at $12 million and took 18 months, and it exceeded our engineering and design expectations.
All right. Does that mean we're going to have a project soon?
That means we're still trying to make this a commercially viable project.
Well, I appreciate the stuff you've brought us. It's really helpful. We always struggle to have good information, and that's really valuable. Our chairman keeps asking the question, you know, what about the hub concept? And, you know, it does appear to be viable to, at some point now or in the future, to sell gas into Midwest, you know, and so on. Can we do both? And can we sweeten the pie or twist your arm until we build a big pipeline as far as the hub and then, you know, LNG somewhere in South Central and a potential of gas pipeline going east? But is it possible to either do both or provide for both as we get started here?
We certainly believe there's enough gas for us to do both projects. And we're going to continue to getting ready to go into my next section on Stage 2. Part of the reason we're going forward is we believe that while we don't have a commercially viable project at this point, we were confident enough with what we did find that it kept us interested. One of the things we will look at is how do we share costs with the Lower 48 project, and is that going to add additional value to us? So certainly from that perspective, we want to look forward. And there's still that pie, that plum out there of can we get the LNG markets at the turn of the decade.
And one last question, I'm almost embarrassed to ask, what's the conversion factor between a gas at measured in cubic feet at atmospheric pressure or whatever, and tons of LNG?
Well, you get a couple of different numbers there, and I've got an engineer sitting here. I'm a commercial guy, but the number I usually use, and the reason you have two different numbers, a lot of times it's what's the entry, what do I have to put into the pipe at the beginning versus what do I take out. The one I like to use for rough numbers is I take the MTPA and take that times 0.14, and that'll take you to BCFD, billion cubic feet a day. Somewhere between 0.14, 0.13.
1.4 times a ton.
0.14.
0.14
times a ton will give you the
ton
BCF per day, billion cubic feet per day.
It's the tons per year. 0.14 times the tons per year equals the billion standard cubic feet per day.
Right. What does, how many, if you got one ton of LNG, how many cubic feet of gas at atmospheric pressure?
That's 140 million per day, so whatever that is. Or he's trying to get per day or per?
He wants without time.
That's right. One ton. What is one ton? How many cubic feet in it? You can scratch your head and tell me afterwards. I've got to go to another meeting. I apologize. I appreciate your
response. We just wanted to test your engineering prowess.
I get a low grade on this one.
Didn't that answer or that question on the high school exam? No.
You have to
do with Boyle's Law, as I remember.
Don't go away, Matt.
It should be. And for Alaska, you know, we should be able to convert that. That should be one of the high school tests, all you guys on the... Anyway, okay, where were we?
Okay, well, we just finished our stage one work. We were happy with the results that we found. We still didn't have a cost-competitive project, but we were encouraged enough to continue on with our stage two work. Realizing we had the engineering design work pretty well lined out, we decided to go forward with stage two, and that's what I'll talk about here. Our timing for this stage began last September. It's a 12 to 15 month program, costing about $3 million for a budget. We're certainly continuing our design cost optimization work. We're working very hard now on the shared the synergy of shared costs with a lower 48 pipeline. Very interested in the value of a public entity or a port authority concept to our project. And it's very important that we look at the key risk. What are the risks associated with this project and how can those risks be mitigated? We're also looking at alternate markets, including the U.S. and Mexico West Coast, now that we've seen the paradigm shift in gas market to the lower 48. And we're looking at the competing projects. Before, our focus has been very internal on how do we get economically viable. Now, how do we stack up with the other projects in the rest of the world? And that will be a lot of our effort going forward in this stage. And then a permitting analysis, we're continuing to develop that. We are doing a environmental assessment for the Cook Inlet route as we speak to make sure that we have both these routes up to the same standards and can move crisply forward if indeed we get the go-ahead to go forward to the project. What we've done, some of the efforts that have gone on just quickly today as far as highlights, we have identified additional CapEx, capital expenditure optimization of about $400 million. That takes our market entry project of the 7.8 million tons per annum down to a $6.5 billion project, including ships, or a $4.9 billion without ships. And we're certainly still trying to identify other cost savings opportunities that might be shared with the Lower 48 Pipeline project. Looking at the public entity valuation, we have done an evaluation on that, on how we might be able to join with a public entity to form a project. Our current view from our analysis is that there's no compelling advantage for a joint public-private project at this point. Generally speaking, without going into a lot of details, the benefits passed to the private enterprise will be taxable to us. Public borrowing rates that we will see would be unlikely to offset the private entity deduction of interest and depreciation that we would see. So for us, on a finance project, we're better off than trying to do something jointly with a private entity project. And then certainly our other stage two activities are in progress and on schedule, certainly.
Well, I need to ask, thank you, Mr. Chairman, I need to ask a question. Does that include the Port Authority, which claims that they have certain tax advantages that might offset some of the cost?
If right now it would include, yes, any type of public entity, and it's not, doesn't mean there won't be something that we can find down the road that might match up, but the types of structures that we've seen so far wouldn't match up between the two, the public and the private. Yeah.
So, Mr. Chairman, if I could, I would also say this doesn't comment on the Port Authority or a government entity doing a project on their own. This
exactly.
is primarily trying to put a project that's public and private together. Because the tax exemptions and tax relief that the Port Authority has, the moment they try to pass that benefit on to a private party, it becomes taxable. So the standalone is another matter.
Now, just a couple of moments on market engagement and where we are on market engagement and the type of contacts that we're making. As I mentioned earlier, we have our market liaison office giving us the continuing feedback. We have our individual corporate contacts giving us the feedback. But for us, again, until we have a fully defined cost-competitive project developed, and until we're at a point where there's a need for new greenfield projects being established, our market contacts are limited to keeping the marketplace updated on our progress, where we are, and that we're trying to advance the project. We are not out there trying to negotiate a final deal, if you will, with the marketplace until we have that in hand. Now, for instance, we have, when we came up with our market entry project, our 7-million-ton project, we wrote a letter. We hand-carried that letter to each of the markets within our target area and discussed that with them. When we went to stage two, again, hand-carried the letter. I've been over there a couple of times to talk to several of the bigger marketplaces, again, to give them a little more formal update on what we've been doing. Again, making them aware that certainly we want to be able to sell Alaska gas to these markets. As soon as we have developed a cost-competitive project, we'll be moving forward in that regard. And certainly on the other piece of that, we are continuing to look at how we stack up with the other markets on a competitive basis, and we're still looking at the non-traditional markets, as we're calling them right now, which is the West Coast market area. On the economic issues, again, for us, the key is to become cost competitive with other East Asian LNG projects at a sufficient economic rate of return. From our standpoint, this project is not quite there yet. We're working to get there. We want to get there. And it's certainly not economic on a cost of capital basis for us for the expected risk that we would have to take for a project of this size and this magnitude. Considerable additional efforts to get us there. We're still continuing to try to reduce costs. Made strides toward that already in our stage two efforts. We want to continue to look at sharing costs and find other synergies, reduce our risk, and then try to achieve meaningful fiscal modification if possible. Now, for us, the truth here is project economic assumptions must be saleable. I can run a scenario that gives me an economic project at the end of the day. I can come up with a price that's high enough. I can come up with a ramp up that's high enough. There's plenty of things I can do. But at the end of the day, I have to be able to obviously sell it internally that my economic assumptions are sound and correct. I have to be able to sell it to the investment community, and I have to be able to sell it to the markets as well as the suppliers, which includes the state of Alaska. Is this really and truly correct economic premises for a viable project? And that's the effort that we're on right now.
And on that point,
yes, sir.
There's a number of projects that you, way back in on your LNG market view slide,
correct?
That you have a whole bunch of competition there. I'd like you to maybe go down that list: Australia, Malaysia. How do you pronounce it? Hangu?
Hangu?
Could you give me a breakdown of who owns the primary interest in each one of those projects?
I cannot. I don't have that information in front of me. I can certainly get that for you, but that's not something I'm walking around with in my head here today.
I guess I've got
looking at markets and who's competing against you and what markets you're going to compete in. You're the market guy, right?
No, I'm not. I'm the commercial manager for this project. We have a market lead that that developed our analysis and is leading our market effort.
And Phillips own Australia? Aren't they in Australia, Phillips and BP?
Phillips is in, which one is he?
Yeah, in the, Mr. Chairman, in the table here, the Bayou.
That's Phillips.
That's in the Timor Sea area, and that's a Phillips. Has an interest with other companies there.
So Phillips is Bayou, and they have some in Australia too, right?
Bayou is basically Australia. Oh, okay. The Timor Sea is off the northwest coast of Australia near the area of Darwin.
Okay. So Australia, NWS, is BP?
North Shelf.
Malaysia, Tigra? Do you know who owns that? Tangguh is BP, right?
I understand.
That was a ARCO holding, right?
And British Gas.
And Qatar, BP.
Mr. Chairman, I think we could we'll gladly go get this information and bring it back to you, rather than just trying to guess at it.
That'd be good, because I'm just like to see the relationship between. You know, the companies that have the you know, you said you had to justify it internally, but I just wanted to see the relationship between what you're justifying internally and the global forces that are competing within the same companies and look at those conflicts. So I'd like to have a discussion about that maybe when we're done. Thanks.
Next to the last slide here, looking at our current CapEx, we talked to you in terms of a $6.5 billion project. This is the breakdown that we see for the different components for the gas treatment facilities, the pipeline and compression. This is a Nikiski example in this case, and then the shipping costs. Certainly, we're continuing to work to improve our economics. Not yet cost competitive with the other new projects in the world that we don't think we are. That's part of the process we're going through, is to better understand how we do stack up with those projects. And the reality is there are other projects that are already at Tidewater that don't have an 800-mile pipeline between them and the LNG terminal. So we're seeking to improve our economics with the shared cost of the Lower 48 pipeline as a primary tactic of our Stage 2 efforts. I guess I would say in closing that certainly this project is still alive and well. We've got a lot of work ongoing, attempting to develop this cost-competitive project. And certainly we want to be prepared, but we also want to be realistic about market timing and how we enter the marketplace. With that, I'll complete my comments and certainly take any of your questions, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Chairman. I guess I'm kind of confused because one of your statements, you said you're not competitive with other projects in the world, but you don't know what the other projects are and who owns them. So how can you know whether or not they're competitive if you don't have that knowledge off even on top of your head?
And again, if you recall, I stated that our initial goal was trying to get ourselves on an economic footing, an economically justifiable project internally. Now we're looking outward in this stage and starting to develop that right now. In fact, we have a workshop here in coming up in March where we'll begin to walk through those very issues on which how we stack up the other projects, what do they look like on a cost of service basis, et cetera, compared to us.
Maybe you could give me an idea what kind of a netback is your company's or the producer's bottom line to make the project viable.
Netback to
the producers.
No, I don't have that specific number on what it would take to give to the producers to make that happen. We would need to, you know, that depends on what you're seeing as an absolute price for the LNG that you sell, et cetera. Comment on it.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, the focus on the sponsor group commercial structure is to buy gas at the wellhead and sell LNG.
So buy back will essentially be the net back what the producers need to get to their bottom line and what the wellhead price is going to be?
Well, what we anticipate is that there's going to be a negotiation that has to take place, and it's going to be complex with lots of terms and conditions about how that purchase would take place and how it relates to the market price and so forth. And so I think it's pretty difficult to establish just a rule of thumb number, and it's, I think, not really appropriate to try to just do a rule of thumb, what's the minimum price or what's the net back, because it's going to be complicated and it's going to depend on a lot of factors.
Do you know, and if any other committee members have questions, I'd be happy to take them. Do you know if there's a gas balancing agreement between the producers on the North Slope?
Mr. Chairman, I'm also here to discuss for Phillips as well. And no, there's not a gas balancing agreement on the North Slope.
Maybe you could give us a, can you give us a thumbnail sketch of what a gas balancing agreement is in your view? What, how it works? I mean, I know it's kind of a difficult question off the top of your head, but.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not an expert in gas balancing, but I'll give it a good shot and then we can get a better answer for you. But the idea behind a gas balancing agreement is to establish the process by where all the correlative rights, if you will, the rights that each individual owner has in these jointly operated or jointly owned fields, that they have the rights to that gas and that someone else isn't basically taking their gas. So the gas balance agreement is a way to establish that process. Say in a simple case, one day someone isn't able to deliver their gas to the market, you have to have a process by which you can true up that, we call it overlift or underlift, whatever it might be. So it runs the range from those circumstances to maybe people have differentially sized projects and you have to establish how that gas is going to be, if you will, trued up so that everyone's rights are protected in a unit setting.
So does a lack of gas balancing agreement give one company a de facto veto power? I mean, if you don't have a balancing agreement ahead of time, doesn't that kind of put you guys at a disadvantage to want to buy from these guys and they don't even have that worked out yet?
That's not the way I see it, Mr. Chairman. The existence or lack of existence of a gas balancing agreement historically in the industry has not been a sort of a process by which, you know, people have held up projects. I think as the economic interests converge and there's a desire to move forward, then these kinds of agreements are worked out. It's historically true in other fields as well. So I don't really see that model.
Just thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just following up on that, is the gas balancing agreement mostly intended to ensure fairness?
Mr. Chairman, Representative James, I'm not sure what you mean by fairness.
You make a decision about how you're going to do something, and then later you measure it. If you did it that way, isn't that really? And then if you did it the way you agreed, that's fair. Isn't that kind of what a gas balancing agreement is? So that you have the mechanism before you do it, so that when you do it, you know what the mechanism is.
Mr. Chairman, Representative James, that's right. Yeah, it's a way of establishing prospectively the rules under which gas can be taken, and. Yeah, you adhere to the rules as an equity, as part of the equity, yes.
Thank you. Representative Jewell has joined us as well. Thank you, Representative Jewell. There's a June 30th deadline for an application for projects that wish to take advantage of House Bill 393 a couple years ago. Are you going to make that deadline?
Certainly, we believe we're qualified to do that. We are prepared to do that. That date doesn't coincide with certainly what we're seeing from the marketplace as far as time of need. We plan to decision that within this upcoming quarter.
Have you had any discussions with the market and I guess who would that market be? Maybe you could identify who your customers, potential customers would be.
Mr. Chairman, our potential customers are all of the markets within Japan, Taiwan, and South Korea that we've talked to, and we've communicated with each of them. I don't have a list in front of me, but it's everybody from the Tokyo Gases and Tokyo Electrics on forward from there.
Do you consider Mr. Meraki a major player in that?
I certainly would.
Is he fairly Do you think he'd have an advantage on market analysis being there and maybe having his finger on the pulse all the time? Or?
I would think he would have a buyer's perspective on market analysis, certainly.
Any other members have any questions?
Mr. Chairman, just a thought occurred to me on reading. You've done it looks like a real thorough job on both routes coming down either to Anderson Bay or to Nikiski. Provided you had come down or you anticipate coming down to Anderson Bay or Valdez, have you done any studies at all on what it would take to do a lateral from Glen Allen somewhere back into Cook Inlet and to Nikiski so that you would have to expand, of course, the volume of the throughput to supply both Anderson and Nikiski? Have you done any preliminary work on that?
We have done certainly work on taking gas, in-state gas supplied out of the Nikiski route, taking it to Anderson Bay. We've always assumed that someone else would build the spur line over to Anchorage, that wouldn't be a part of the project. Have we looked at costs for building such a line in both of those markets?
Thank you. Maybe you could, I don't know if you had the opportunity to look at this, the political and business conditions in places like Yemen, Qatar, Natuna, and Sakhalin compared to Alaska. In your view, is there an advantage for the markets to look to Alaska for our political stability and our military strength in the Pacific Rim and those kind of things something that would give us a leg up even over some of the projects that are at Tidewater, for example?
Yeah, I think we bring two strengths to the marketplace. One of those is certainly our political stability, and the other is a known established gas supply that's already in existence on the North Slope. So those are two distinct advantages that I think Alaska brings to the table that many of the other projects that we'll be competing against won't have. And that's part of what we intend to do, is not only just go back and look on straight-up cost-of-service basis, but how else do we compete with these projects and how realistic are some of these other projects as far as really being able to come together at the end of the day also. Yes.
Mr. Chairman, if I might expand on that for just a moment.
Finland?
Yes. The question might be, to what extent will the markets value these assets or these advantages that Alaska has that Steve just mentioned? I think the way we view this is we see that fundamentally and first and foremost, the market is going to look for the lowest cost supply, and that these other issues, I wish it were different, but it looks like these other issues are secondary issues that we will try to take advantage. But the number one issue is always going to come back to being a competitively priced source of supply for the market.
That's a very good point.
Right, and because of that, we've got some internal conflicts with some of the producers' projects that compete. So the same people who are producers in Alaska have projects that are in direct competition with Alaska's project, and the comments that are made on the record by some of the producers that, Alaska just isn't competitive. The projects that are funded or that are good projects get funded by our company and those kind of things. But there's these internal conflicts, and I'm kind of fearful that because there's gas in other areas that are at Tidewater, we don't have to build a $7 billion pipeline, that our gas will be warehoused, possibly an indefinite time. And I remember all the discussion. I've been here for a while, and I remember all the discussion about, you have to build this expensive pipeline and a capital investment. And I don't see much difference between that argument with LNG, why it might not be competitive in the market, versus that argument on a pipeline route to the lower 48. You have to build a very expensive pipeline that's three times as long as our pipeline, and then compete in a market where there's already lots of gas down there that's just not in the pipes yet. And there's plenty of supply in the lower 48. It's not a matter that they're out of gas or just don't have enough in the system right now. So I don't know. I guess it,
for me, if I was in your shoes, I'd be a little bit discouraged by comments within, like, well, the governor's comments in the paper, you know, what part of no do they not understand on LNG? Those kind of things must be discouraging, especially in the comments from, frankly, some of the producers, their attitude towards LNG. And it must be tough for you guys to keep your nose to the grindstone to make this thing happen, and in spite of all that negativity. Could you care to comment on that?
Mr. Chairman, I would comment on that. I would say, first, since we do believe there's enough gas for both projects, it behooves us to continue forward, to stay the course, if you will, to develop LNG. I certainly, from a Phillips standpoint, have a directive to continue to explore this option because we want to develop every option that's out there for us. We see the Lower 48 project as bringing a potential leveraging synergy for us to still do an LNG project. So we're encouraged by that piece, that indeed that there might be a synergy for us down the road. And we haven't given up on. We don't know what tomorrow is going to bring from a market standpoint or from a directional standpoint. So we feel very feels very important that we stay the course.
Yeah, I did, and it's back to this issue of back a little bit to the issue of some of the same companies owning the gas in other parts of the world. And I've struggled with this issue. And one of the things that you said. Is you said the very first consideration is the least cost. So there is certainly a perception that we have this much gas here that belongs to BP or Phillips or anyone, and there's this much over here that belongs also to them. So they have there's a perceived bias. Probably it's not even perceived. It's probably a reality bias. But in the marketplace, wouldn't the issue still be driven by the cost to get the product to market regardless of who the owner was?
Mr. Chairman, Representative James, yes, that's exactly right. You know, for many years I was in the ARCO chair, and we talked about this issue, and I kept coming back to say, you know, it's really Mother Nature that put that gas where it is. It's been discovered. It wouldn't matter who owns it. If it's being developed and if the costs are attractive to the marketplace, that's where the market's going to focus their attention and try to get it. So it isn't a question of, to me, so much of who owns. It's a question of what are the fundamental characteristics of the gas supply and what's required to make it market, to commercialize it and get it to market. And that's the area, like we've said it, we'll come back, and we're a broken record here, but that's the focus I think we need to have in Alaska is how do we get ourselves cost competitive with these other projects?
Follow up on that issue, which is the one issue that I think the public is most concerned about. And that is that these companies, because of the perceived or maybe reality of bias, are going to say that, you know, it's cheaper for us to do it over there unless you want to give us some additional benefits here in Alaska because it's pretty expensive to get it out of here. And so that's what we deal with as legislators all the time. We have that same concern. And the public really has that concern. And so my question to you is, how do we answer them on that issue?
Mr. Chairman, Representative James, the way I get to that answer is that this really is about the fundamental cost structure of projects. And it's not about some kind of gaming here. That's the way I see it. It's not about gaming, trying to get concessions. It's about fundamental costs. And sure, as we pointed out in our presentation earlier, for example, federal tax relief on an Alaskan project can make a big difference in how competitive it looks in the marketplace. But then you're sort of instantly to a social question. Is that what's in the interest of, is that in the public's interest to do that sort of thing in order to get a project to go ahead and be competitive? But I think it just comes back to the fundamentals of these cost projects and that we have to understand that the fact that it's 800 miles away from Tidewater is an issue that we have to find a way to overcome in terms of some kind of innovation.
Going back then also to the comment that you made that there does not seem to be an advantage between a public-private partnership. But you said that was not the calculation of a public ownership as opposed, I mean, a public ownership as opposed to a private ownership if the tax issue was set aside because of the public ownership. So did you do any kind of consideration? Your project here is to build a gas line, the LNG plant and the ships and sell and buy and sell. That's your project. So I can see why you may not have even looked at the issue as to whether or not if we, as a public ownership, build a pipeline and then charge you to take your gas through it. Have you done anything, any kind of consideration such as that?
Chairman, Representative James, we're in that process right now, and we've had a couple of discussions with the Port Authority. They're sort of the best model right now of that. That there's somebody to talk to about that point, and we've looked at the state calculations of what sort of benefits would there be to an enterprise that was relieved from federal tax, and it looks attractive. But how is that all going to be structured, I think, is a matter that has to really be sort of discussed and worked through. And we have a productive relationship with the Gas Pipeline Port Authority, and we're going to be talking with them here in March again about possible opportunities here. We certainly have not ruled that out. Chairman, Representative James, when ARCO first led the formation of that, of the sponsor group, we invited a variety of different companies, and at the time we really chose not to explicitly give the names of all of them because we wanted to respect their ability to talk to us and candidly tell us whether they were interested or not, and included many non-Alaskan companies as well, if you recall our discussions at the time. And we sort of held to that, to not really sort of talk about the nature of conversations that we've had with other companies about that. And so we've included the Alaskan producers in that category as well. We are what we are now, which is the sponsor group that you see here. You have quite a bit of gas represented by those two names. And in my mind, I include the state royalty gas as another possibility here as well. So there's enough reserves behind that group. That's why Steve was saying it's a qualified sponsor group under the Stranded Gas Development Act, that the participation of one company or not is not really sort of a leveraging thing here.
We got a couple of questions for you, unless somebody else has anything. Now, Phillips has interest in TMRC, is that correct? You own TMRC? And are there any provisions in the laws that penalize or jeopardize Phillips for delaying bringing natural gas into production in Timor Sea?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know the answer to that question specifically, but what I do know is that we ought to avoid a situation where we try to compare just one element of the concession and fiscal system in one entity with the leasing and fiscal system here in Alaska, that we say, oh, well, they're doing this one thing in that area, and shouldn't we be doing the same thing in Alaska? I think you have to make a comparison of the whole thing in totality. You know, we have a very strong leasing system here in Alaska where leases are offered, they're bid on, development has taken place. We have a fiscal structure that's at the pleasure, basically, of the state government as it's a sovereign power. And so I would guard against comparisons of just one element of something compared to what we do here. I think they should be evaluated in their totality.
Well, yeah, I'm attempting to do that, but part of the evaluating in totality is comparing what Alaska's gas is competing against. Certainly, if Alaska's gas is competing against a scenario in another country where producers are penalized for not producing it, and we don't have that, we're not competing on a level playing field. Obviously, there's going to be a major incentive to develop other gas in that country first. So I think it's part of the big picture that we need to look at, and I'd appreciate an answer on that question. If you could actually, I've actually asked that question of Phillips already, so I'm going to get an answer in writing soon. But
Mr. Chairman, if I might,
sure.
We'll do our best. One thing that you said there I wanted to respond to, which is I really have a hard time believing that some kind of punitive measure is going to help us become more cost competitive relative to other projects. I just have trouble conceptualizing something that's a penalty and therefore makes us more cost competitive. And I'm glad to be wrong here, but that I just don't see it.
It's probably not a cost competitive thing, but you know, certainly if you're a board of directors and you have a fiduciary responsibility to your stockholders, and you know, if you don't develop gas in a certain area, and you're going to lose the gas or you're going to have to pay a tax on it, that's one of the factors in your decision of who gets developed first. So you know, I just think it's something, information that we don't have that committee needs to just, you know, we're not looking going there, but we just need to where we're need to know where we're at with the other competing projects. I guess I'd need to know what your strategy for securing a gas supply is, and what assumptions you're making for a wellhead price.
Our gas strategy is that we would have an open bid process. We would allow all of the producers to bid to supply gas to an Alaska North Slope LNG project, and we would ask them to offer up a price that they'd be willing to pay in that regard. And take the lowest bidder. Obviously, if we're not competitive with what they can do other places, we won't see gas.
And do you have any assumptions on what a wellhead price might be?
No, I do not.
Do you know what gas is selling for on the East Coast or delivering LNG to the East Coast? I think there's maybe 4 to 5 facilities that have been brought out of mothballs or coming out of mothballs. And I believe there's at least one that's LNG is being delivered from, I'll slip my mind where it's coming from, but do you have an idea what it's being delivered to the East Coast?
What the delivered price at the East Coast would be, the current market price in those particular areas, it would be the Henry Hub price, minus, or plus that differential. I don't have that in front of me right now, but it's going to be the current market price plus. Current U.S. lower 48 Henry Hub market price plus. If that's $4, that may be $4.20, wherever that point is. I would just have to go case by case.
So that's sold on a spot market basis then, in the East Coast, or is that a long-term contract?
When you get up into the Everett, Massachusetts area, I believe that's a long-term contract. I don't know what the other markets are looking at yet at this point. Cove Point and Elba Island are recently coming out of mothballs. And you also have the facility there in Louisiana also.
So you're saying long-term contracts is based on Henry Hub Plus?
I'm saying at those particular market points that you were talking about on Cove Point and Elba Island, it would likely be whatever. There is a market differential between the Henry Hub price and Louisiana to wherever the delivery takes place. And I'm just saying that that's going to be a slightly different number than what it is at Henry Hub, but it will be the current market price for that location.
In stage one, you mentioned that after going through that stage, LNG was not really economical at this point. We've been discussing the wellhead price. We've been discussing the market. And we as yet haven't established what the market of the future is going to be, whether it will hold, what it is. We haven't established really what the wellhead price is going to be. But somehow we don't yet really know whether this is going to be economical in the future, because we don't know those things. Do we have any grasp on what the cost of capital is going to be based upon your projections here, or what the cost of construction is going to be relative to those things that you don't know? Really is what I'm getting at. Is through these questions, I haven't yet determined that the gas is not economical at this point, because you have made some assumptions that when we've asked the questions, you can't answer them. So how do we know, then, that the gas isn't economical at this point? If we could pin down, if you could send, or we could know what you anticipate the wellhead price is going to be, if we could anticipate by the time that you get your permitting and could get a gas line completed, what the market would be, and these are only projections, and they are assumptions, but it would give us a better handle, and I think a better opportunity to determine really whether it's economical at that point in the future when the completion of these projects see the end. Right now, as it seems to me, Mr. Chairman, it's difficult to determine, based on what I've heard here, whether it really is or is not economical. Is that a pretty fair statement?
I see heads nodding in agreement. So we don't record those on recording. Maybe you can answer.
I would say the pieces that we've given you here are the capital costs broken down. We haven't tried to impute a cost of service to put in front of you. Obviously, our any forecasted long-term price would normally be confidential and within our company. But that wouldn't preclude us from giving you the basic raw data that you might be able to. The problem I have with giving, for instance, a cost of service number is compared to what? Some people will look at that on a finance basis. Some will look at that on an unfinanced basis. what are people imputing into that? Certainly we can give you the raw numbers. We just gave you the raw CapEx numbers, and I think the data is generally there and would support the going forward with someone taking a single look at these projects and imputing it, again, based on your assumptions. We're all going to have a different set of assumptions on how we look at it, whether this is a profitable project or not.
Just follow up, Mr. Chairman. Well, I certainly don't want to, or wish, certainly, to have anybody divulge any proprietary information. But on the other hand, as we look at this thing, every time we have a hearing or have an overview of these things, we also get these assumptions, and they always come up from saying that it's not economic. When are we going to hear that it is economic? Because they're still based on assumptions, and we still haven't heard whether or not we can even make the computations in our own mind as to whether they're going to be economic. So these exercises could continue, basically. These exercises could continue ad nauseum, so to speak, into the future, because everything still is based on assumptions then. So it's and even though we understand that you want to get the pipeline going and make a profit, that's what this whole thing is for, it has come out that there are other, certainly, at least competing, appears to be competing things that and even you have your own internal profits and your own balance sheets to look at, which are certainly proprietary. You have those things to look at. You have your shareholders to watch out for. But those interests to you are your interests as they should be. But our interests are the stockholders that we have to answer to, and that's the people in the state of Alaska. So we would like to have these things at least as far as you can answered so that we can start making some predictions too. And if nothing else, try to speed you folks up in the process.
I'm not going to comment on that. I've been in these meetings almost ad nauseum, if you will. I mean, George's been there for a long time. A number of us in the room have been there for a long time, and I don't really, my patience with these things are running a little bit thin because it's been a lot of years, and we don't seem to be that much closer. But I do have, I don't know, do you have a response to his?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Faith, I was sitting here thinking it's so much easier when you have an economic project. We all feel good. We're all happy. We're all moving ahead. I mean, the plain fact is we just are not cost competitive. How we prove that, I think, I'm not sure that you can prove the negative here. What I look for is what are the activities? What are people doing to move ahead? You know, we have our sponsor group, and we are... we did a tremendous amount of work. Sometimes people may overlook the extent of that work in our sponsor group, but we spent, you know, $12 million and came up with an innovative design where we actually shrunk the project without suffering the kind of cost disadvantages that one would expect on a per-unit basis. Very innovative work. So we're really trying to push ahead here, and yet at the same time we look at the market, it's oversupplied, it's fiercely competitive, and we're not seeing in the marketplace, you know, a sense that we're in the running right now for the near term. We see the market saying, well, no, you're kind of more like a later decade type of project. And I don't know how to, I know the problem you're mentioning, I don't know if there's a sort of a magic wand to solve this, but to me, we just keep looking at what are the activities, who are doing things that are trying to move ahead, who's spending the money, and try to be very realistic with ourselves about the market.
Maybe I could ask that. Did you have something?
Go ahead.
Good thing, George.
There's a couple of things that concern me. You have a mandate that says to become economic sufficient in 7 to 8 MTPA, even if the future expansion never occurs. But another company that's competing that feels that is basically a kiss of death because you can't make the project competitive at that level of production. They feel that they can, you know, I'm talking about YP, I'm sure you know, feel that, you know, they need about twice as much to go into the market. And based on Meraki's assessment of the market and maybe the changes since the governor and some of the producers have gone over and talked with the market, especially in maybe shift and focus away from nuclear energy onto natural gas, that there's going to be even a greater market demand than previously projected. I guess, you know, we've got a company that says if they're ready to build a pipeline, if they could just have the same open bid process that you're interested in, if they could get the gas. And they've been at it a lot longer than you guys have. You know, I guess, you know, have you just not done enough work, or you know something they don't, they know something you don't? What's the deal?
Mr. Chairman, now my wife was in retailing for a while, and she always said, don't talk about your competition. Talk about your own assets, and I think that's what I'm going to do. We have put a lot of work into this, and what other people are saying, that's what they can say. If they can make a project happen, that's fine. You know, we view this as Steve was talking about, the how do we acquire gas. We're thinking of that as an entity, as a sponsor group, not necessarily as a producer. So we don't have any particular, nothing makes us particularly special in our ability to try to go and acquire gas, differential from anyone else, other than we have a lot of work behind us that we've done on designing the facility and understanding where we would want to be. So there's nothing preventing us, I mean, there's nothing that makes us special or differential in doing that.
Mr. Chairman, if I could continue to respond, as you spoke of the smaller market entry project versus the larger project, again, it's about the market risk, about getting ourselves into the marketplace. We feel like we've developed a project that's economically good or better, actually better than what we were able to come up with on our 14 million ton project. Now, if I can get 14 million tons into the marketplace and I can get it into the marketplace the next day, certainly. I would want to expand immediately as quickly as I possibly could. But again, it's about trying to couch something in a form to where I can get a toehold into the marketplace. And if the market proves to be there and there is a room for me to put 14 million tons in the marketplace, then I'm just as eager as the next guy.
Maybe I could talk a little bit about the West Coast United States market. BP recently announced an interest in building a receiving facility there, as well as I believe El Paso has been looking at that as well. And looks like we're getting permits in California. It's kind of hard, but I think people are talking to me about Mexico. If I'm not mistaken, President Bush has been talking about looking at easing some of the restrictions of another country selling us power, so Mexico could possibly sell us power. It might be easier to get a permit in Mexico. I'm not don't want to comment on the record about that process. I'm sure it's different than ours. But are you looking at the West Coast market, and what do you think the cost or the delivered price on the West Coast might be?
Mr. Chairman, certainly we we are now focusing on the West Coast market. We started this project with a focus on the target East Asian marketplace. We've seen the dynamics change in the marketplace, and we've certainly seen the high prices that California has had. It gets back to what is a sustained price over time that we can gain market entry. Same thing that the Lower 48 pipeline will have to look at. But yes, that will be, that is one of our focuses going forward.
So you think that there could be some synergies with piggybacking on the Lower 48 pipeline? And I mean, obviously you get your gas halfway there or you're half built.
That's exactly what we're looking at. How do those, keep in mind, they'll still want us to pay a toll to get that, but from a capital expense standpoint and a shared cost standpoint, then certainly that has the potential to have a leveraging effect, certainly.
What do you think would the effect on all these projects would be if the state bellied up to the bar and said we're building a pipeline, enough capacity for both projects to Fairbanks? Then, I mean, it'd be an interesting scenario, but what do you think?
Mr. Chairman, it is an interesting scenario. Built into that is an assumption, or a couple of assumptions I think you need to, as the state needs to think about pretty carefully, which is, plainly stating it, the ability to execute a project like that in a cost-competitive way. You know, the state needs to feel like they can really do that in a competitive way, because if they don't, you know, basically we're going to be burdened with actually higher costs, and the state's going to want to recover those costs in some form or fashion. And so at the end of the day, it will not have actually been, it would not have made it more competitive for the state to engage in that process unless they've done it in a very efficient way. So I would say that the ability of the state to execute such projects should be really thought about very, very carefully in that scenario.
Well, even if we didn't build like a whole pipeline to Fairbanks, but if we were part owners in some of the pipeline, I mean, I think there might be some advantages that some of the information that is proprietary that you won't share with us now, that as an owner, we get that information, at least the people that are involved in the day-to-day operations and the decision-making would be. You know, we do own 12.5% of the gas, and maybe we should own 12.5% of these projects. But you guys have objections to state looking at that?
Mr. Chairman, no. I mean, no objection to look at anything here.
We did a little bit more than kick tires, I guess.
Sorry, I got a person on behalf.
Oh, no, I wasn't.
I really think the line should be built based on economics, as you guys have noted, and I think it should be based on whether the market justifies going ahead and expending all that money and so forth, and I have no problem with being patient and waiting for this thing to unfold and eventually become feasible. You know, I don't think we as a legislature should stumble over ourselves in a big rush to try to get this pipeline built, just simply to get it built. I certainly want to see you know, stimulus to the economy by building a pipeline and more jobs generated and dollars flowing within the economy, but I don't think it should be some kind of artificial stimulus, you know, through the legislature just forcing your hand. I think it should be a case where if there's a market and a demand for the product, then we should encourage you to go ahead. And I don't like that concept, with all due respect to whoever made this observation, that we had a consider some kind of penalty. Maybe that wasn't a suggestion, and if I'm wrong, I apologize, but you know, if anything, we ought to be providing an incentive to the industry and providing a tax cut. I mean, if we want you guys to get off your duff and get out there and build the line, maybe we ought to look at some kind of incentive package, and I like the idea of some kind of tax incentive, tax reductions. I know that will have a negative impact on our royalties as far as the state treasury, but I think our overall objective should be contributing to the economy and generating jobs and dollars flowing in our economy that this will provide. So therefore, I think that emphasis should be tax reductions if our goal and intent is to in fact see this thing built, and it's not market feasible at this point. Thank you.
Thank you. little bit on what Representative Coring has to say. Because of my background in accounting, and I'm sure that has something to do with the comments that we got from Representative Coring as well, I don't like to push the envelope, because I find that when you do that, you lose. And so I'm a conservative person when it comes to making projections, and I assume that you're taking a conservative or at least the middle of the road and not a real liberal approach to this issue. But my couple of questions I have on the LNG, I understand in the LNG market in the lower 48, and I understand just only from what I read that there's been some reduction in the cost of producing LNG by a new systematic or a new method or some new modern methods come in. And so my first question is, in the LNG plant on the Kenai, do you have to retrofit it to get that benefit, or is it already the lesser expensive way to go, or tell me what that plant currently does?
I would assume you are referring to the Trinidad LNG facility, which is owned by BP, basically. That is actually a Phillips Petroleum Company process, the cascade process, if you will, that was initiated and developed in Kenai originally. Now, certainly there have been improvements in technology advancements since that facility was built. The project that this group is looking at is a standalone project that would be in a different plant sense than the existing Kenai facility. So I don't know where you were going with that particular comparison there.
I thought you already said you included in one of those sheets, you included the fact that it's there, and so that's an advantage.
What that advantage brings to us, there is a process called extended inflash, and this is a commercial guy, so I'm going to take you as far as I can here. But extended inflash is, as you do the LNG process and start cooling things down, there's always gas that flashes off the end of the process. And normally that's recycled back into the facility and reused again to continue to make LNG. So you've got some gas, in effect, recycling. By extended inflash, you can take that gas off, and it's very similar to spraying a spray can of paint or whatever. You notice that it'll get colder. When you can actually push that gas off and release that pressure, you can actually make more LNG than you could otherwise. That's a very simplistic answer, and I'm sure that there's probably engineers rolling over laughing at me at this point, but that's the process that's involved. What you can do then is sell it to another infrastructure. Example, sell it to the Kenai facility and let them take that gas and then put it in their process. So that's the advantage that you have by using the existing Kenai facility.
Okay, so my interest in this question has to do with the indication that there's going to be opening up some of these other LNG facilities because of the less cost of producing LNG and the higher cost of natural gas has made LNG more competitive with natural gas. And so I didn't know what that ratio is and whether you knew what it was either before, without using this new reduction in the production cost, what would be the ratio of the BTUs of using LNG to the BTUs of natural gas? What is that? Do you know what that relationship is? And what would the cost of natural gas have to go down to make LNG not the favorite again?
If I understand your question correctly, you're asking me effectively what's this new efficiency, what's the additional efficiency that we can get?
And what is the ratio in competitive BTUs of LNG to natural gas?
I don't have that one on me. We'll have to get
it. I don't know, but we can get that information.
But the other comment that I wanted to make, too, is if we, the state, decided that we wanted to be an owner into that, we have capital costs, too. And I'm not quite sure, but what our capital costs might be, I'm not sure. Because it's what else can we do with that money if we don't do that? And so it's a mixed bag. I think one more thing before I complete here, and then I won't have any other questions or comments, is that one of the things that I think we need a lot of is trust in this issue, because I don't want to sit here and ask you to give me your private information that you've worked up and paid for with huge amounts of funds, and I don't want to have to know that. And in order for us to really truly believe you're being honest and faithful with us, we almost need to know all those kinds of things. Otherwise, we're kind of left here just believing people. But I think that we do have to have trust, and one of the things that we have had is a long relationship with these companies, and I think they've done us fairly well. However, be informed that the public is not so generous with their attitude, and we respond to the public. So, and in that response, then, is that you don't have to just convince us. You've got a bigger audience out there.
I've got one other question, unless does anybody else have anything? You know, with the market size of or the size of the project you're looking at building, about 7 MTAs, what other projects do you think will enter in the market before Alaska? Is that why you've downsized, because you think that there's other projects that are going to enter and the market before Alaska gets our gas in, and therefore there's not as much demand?
Well, then you have 20 to 40 million tons per annum of new supply by 2010. As we look at the marketplace, Mr. Meraki was a little more liberal with that, up to 55, I believe, was his number.
Demand.
Demand, excuse me, at that point. Yes, we will be competing with those other projects head-to-head, those other projects that don't have the 800-mile pipeline involved in them. But it gets back down to trying to get into that marketplace, as I said before. Well, if you go back and look at the various ones that are there, we're the only ones talking double digits as far as projects in the 10-plus million tons per annum. All the rest of them are 7 and under. So from that standpoint, again, trying to get, you have to get that first market established, and the second, and the third, and the stacking that you're doing won't be likely selling to one market in this case. So, yeah, it will take us a while to develop that. But, again, if we can do that, we'll do it and try to expand it as quickly as we can.
So, but do you think there will be other markets that, or other producers that will enter the market before Alaska?
Just from a timing standpoint, there's some that are closer to being developed than this one is. From a competitive standpoint, that's what our analysis is going to be over the next few months, or to understand that exactly.
And from a timing standpoint, what projects would those be?
I don't have those all in front of me, but we've got some timing dates out here of possibilities that where they might enter the marketplace.
Can I do
it? Yeah, go ahead,
Mr. Chairman. Yeah, if you go to this. Good. If you go to this chart, there are really no black and white answers here that, oh, this project's absolutely, we know with 100% assurance is going to do this, and now that's it. I mean, each of these projects faces its own set of hurdles, its own set of marketing issues and so forth. And so what we've shown you here is sort of a best guess. These all have little approximate signs in front of them, but it's sort of a best guess of the general sense of sequencing that the market, the LNG market, sort of sees right now. Whether one slips ahead or behind, that's a question that really couldn't be answered, because it's going to depend upon what are the project conditions that are developing for that individual project, and how effective is it at its marketing and so forth.
Well, certainly some companies have made decisions to carry forth with some projects, and certainly if I was in your shoes, behooved me to know who was got the leg up on me, and you guys don't know that?
We will. And as again, I told you, our stage one efforts, we're trying to develop an economic project that reached some reasonable form of hurdle rate. Now it's, well, how do we compare with these other projects? And that's certainly the focus of our stage two work.
Periodicals in the oil industry are always full of articles that say, well, you know, this company has decided to go ahead with, Sakhalin, or, you know, all the different, the tuna was a big deal a couple years ago. There's all these different projects that companies have made decisions that are farther along than you guys are. I mean, you don't know who those are and what they are?
I can certainly give those to you as that type of information. I don't have it sitting here with me today.
I appreciate that. Good. Is there any other questions? Here and now, I think we'll probably close the meeting at this time. And again, I want to thank you very sincerely for your presentation here today. And I hope you have a
better flight out than you did in, and
concur with that.
Not if they're leaving today.
Thanks. Meeting is adjourned. Thank you.